Hello there and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and another audio vide posh overflowing with ear-catching objects, such as the biography in wallpaper of designer Charlotte Curry and the neo-folk tales of artist and comedian Hugh Cooney. But we begin with some likes, those hypnotizing little counts that dominate our experience on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter and all the gang.
Grow more than everyone else, more than half of more growing growth team.
Artist Ben Grosser is in Dublin this week to lead a workshop in digital self-defense, offering to get us tooled up to battle the world of compulsive social networking and the untrammeled data collection that goes along with it. Grosser's work often takes the form of software, such as his browser extension Facebook Demetricator, and aims, if not to take back control, at least to give us more focus on the forces arraigned against us, as Ben Grosser told me on a recent visit to Culture File Towers.
We engineer software, but software in turn engineers us back. And so it's a way of giving individuals the tools to change that relationship so that they aren't always subject to the system. For me, projects usually start from a personal experience of some sort, whether it's my own experience of using an interface or investigating kind of why an interface turned out to be the way it is in terms of a piece of software. That usually leads me down the track, at least at first, of making something. And that's where the kind of more traditional art practice is, except that for me, it's a code-based practice of writing software that gets in between the user and the system that they use every day and allows them to try to understand that system differently. One work, just to kind of give a sense of that, is this work, Facebook Demetricator. It's a browser extension that hides all metrics across the Facebook interface and allows anyone to, you know, use Facebook as they normally would, but no longer see how many likes they have or how many notifications there are, how many people are commenting on a post.
When you were thinking about, or when the idea for the Demetricator came to you, what was the problem that you were addressing?
I just came to a personal realization that I was paying a lot of attention to the numbers on Facebook. This is back in 2011 for me. And I realized that when I would log on to Facebook, the first place I would look is that red and white notification number. And then I would start scanning my feed to see who reacted to me. And what I was looking at was not who reacted or what they said. The first place I was always looking was how many people reacted to me. And I just found myself asking why do I care about these numbers so much? What is it about the system that makes me focus on the quantity rather than the content? I had this intuition that I was really paying a lot of attention. I took the numbers away. I realized I really was paying even more attention than I realized in the first place. And as I started to dig into it, I started to realize that what was going on is that these numbers were activating me as a user to pay attention in certain kinds of ways. They teach me and others what to post and what not to post. You know, we learn because we're so focused on our metric performance within these systems that we should post things that get high metric success and not post the kinds of things that get low metric success.
We had Robert Lustig on the program who's done a lot of research about how exactly those feelings that you're getting when looking at the numbers are created and why. And it seems that it's not an accidental thing, the feelings you're having.
Absolutely not. I mean, I talk about this in what I call the desire for more, that when we see a number that reflects on our sociality, likes, friends, followers, etc., it's really difficult for us to not want that number to be larger. 10 likes is great, 20 is better. 100 followers, okay, but I'd really rather have 200. And that cycle never stops. By design, the presence of the numbers then keep me engaged in the platform and keep me paying attention. My users of Demetricator report that the numbers make them feel anxious, they make them feel competitive, they make them feel compulsive. Taking the numbers away then relieves some of those feelings perhaps the most interesting category of feedback I've gotten is that the presence of the numbers also makes us algorithmic in the way that we interact with Facebook or other social media platforms. We end up creating rules for ourselves about how to act within the system based on what the numbers say, but we do that without realizing it in the first place. I get feedback from people who they install Demetricator and then they realize they're frozen, feeling unable to react because it turns out they'd created a rule for themselves without realizing it that, for example, they only like posts if it has more than, say, 5 or 10 likes. They don't want to be one of the only people who liked a piece of content and then nobody else came along behind them. And so they're not sure what to do. The converse is true at the same time, where people don't want to like a piece of content if it has, say, more than 100 likes, because that person's got enough and maybe they shouldn't have any more, as if likes are a finite resource. These are examples where we are scanning the feed, watching the numbers, reacting to the numbers in ways that we don't even realize, and the numbers are driving our actions.
When you're looking at metrics and how important they are to social media, you're actually, of course, seeing a kind of image of how the businesses see themselves and what's going on in all the businesses that produce these kind of software.
Absolutely. I mean, one of my interests is, why did these numbers end up there in the first place? And certainly one track of answer to that is that they produce ever-increasing engagement. That's why they're there by design, and the companies are invested in as much engagement as we can get. That's how they make their money. That's how they keep everything going. But I also see that a focus on metrics, an obsession with analytics, a need to grow, the desire for more, as I call it. These things are all inherent. They are fundamental to Silicon Valley and kind of the way that these companies emerge.
And your work is a little bit to feed back into that loop somehow, because the companies have noticed what you've done and have noticed the research area that you're investigating.
Yeah, they've certainly noticed it. Their attention to it has seemed, or interest in it seems to have changed some over time. You know, in 2016, this is the summer of 2016. I think it's important, the timing here. They were working to get it kicked off. The fall of 2016 comes, and that's the U.S. presidential election in the United States when Trump was elected. And all of a sudden, the media attention and kind of the focus on the role of social media in society changed, such that now people are asking a lot more questions. And what's emerged in the last year or so, or year and a half, is some beginnings of acknowledgments from the major social media companies about perhaps there's a negative aspect to the presence of these visible metrics within the platform. The first, as I recall, was Jack Dorsey, who talked about the follower metric as, I think the way he puts it is, incentivizing the wrong kinds of behavior or something like that.
He actually tweeted a response to your work specifically.
He did, yes.
Even though Facebook would pretend to have nothing to do with your research, it is appearing in the, like, they own Instagram, and this kind of idea is percolating in there as well.
Right. The next was Instagram, who said, you know, started conducting tests to hide the visible like count from other users, and they've run that test in a few different countries. And the language that they write about very much mirrors the language I was posting in 2012 about, you know, kind of the effects, why we want to care about these numbers in the first place. And now Facebook has turned out they're also conducting their own test. I don't remember where it is in the world. None of these are in the United States right now. So in all these tests that they're running too, you know, they never say much about what is it they're testing or what constitutes
a
successful
really
test.
More than 40%, more than a third of a few thousand more works really well.
The constant need for growth that capitalism requires sets in motion all kinds of processes and paths that may or may not be producing what we hope for from a a working system for society. In the case of Facebook, this massive focus on growth, you know, from my perspective, and I think a lot of people's at this point, is one of the primary reasons why it's become so destructive. You know, why it was easily weaponized against voters in the United States or in the UK and Brexit, for example. It's because of scale. It's because there are so many people there. An individual user is a small component of a much larger system. And so with order of magnitude, you know, if Facebook Demetricator is a way of kind of getting in between the system and the user in order to look at what's happening, order of magnitude is my artistic attempt to kind of really try to understand the founder of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, to go back and look, how has he been speaking about the company? What is the rhetoric he uses? How might it have changed over time? Or how consistent has it been ever since the beginning?
You know, a billion isn't like a magical number. 5 billion. Billions, 699 million. More than 40% of more competition. More. It's more. It's around 20%.
I started just looking at every video recorded appearance that he has made since he first emerged in 2004. The first recording was a short snippet on CNBC. Where he's 19 and he's talking about the company. And I had the idea because of, you know, with Facebook Demetricator, and I've always been interested in kind of this concept of more and how we always want more from the numbers. I thought, oh, maybe I'll just go and take out every time he says the word more and make a supercut out of that. And as I started to watch, I thought, no, I should also include the word grow or growth, any form of the word grow, and then every time he utters a metric, 1 million, 2 billion, etc. And I thought, okay, I'll just go through all the videos, I'll extract those three words, and probably they'll add up to a long supercut of, say, 4 or 5 minutes. But as I started to look at the data and really go through all the videos, it just kept getting bigger and bigger, perhaps appropriately given the subject. The scale just got out of control. To the point where it was hundreds of videos I had to go through, and the material was honestly almost overwhelming for me as an artist, at least in the time frame. The total supercut ended up being 47 minutes long.
Many more. It's going to go more and more, even more.
First of all, when you just talk in numbers all the time, they start to lose their value as communication.
Some of the more 100 times or 1,000 times bigger.
So the film presents the material that I've extracted in a temporal order. So it starts at when he's age 19, it ends when he's age 38. And you see, and you know, you hear numbers over time going up and up and up. And so the first numbers you hear might be, you know, 200,000 or 300,000. And these are the user numbers. He's always using how many users we have right now as an argument. You know, the way he makes this argument is through the numbers. So 200,000, 300,000, 500,000, a million, you know, a billion, or sorry, a million. And then it goes 2 million, 5 billion, 10 million, 100 million, 200 million, 5 million. Then he's talking about billions, 1.2 billion. And that's kind of one curve throughout the work, is how the numbers are just always rising over time. But there's also, and you really see it, I think, in the film, that there's these moments where he is just, there's just so many numbers coming out of him in one stream, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 9,000, 10,000, 100,000, 50,000. It's just, what was being communicated at that point? If you were to go back and really parse it out, you might be able to figure it out what was happening. But you also realize just how much of his speech is spoken through metrics. And that reflects back to, I think, how he thinks and what the values of the company are. It's almost like every speech just requires a new fill in the blank of what the numbers are today. You know, the arguments don't change all that much over time. It's the numbers that change over time, although it's a very predictable kind of change. It's almost like for there to not be a negative story, the numbers have to always be going up. I mean, even if staying the same would create all kinds of negative possibilities for them as a company. There would be all kinds of questions about his, you know, direction of Facebook.
Millions of tens of millions, as many as 2 million, growing and improving quickly, and we'll keep you updated with more soon.
And I mean, Facebook, we're picking on, and you definitely do in your work pick on Facebook a lot. But there are a lot of companies working through the same ideas and the same practices. But as long as the companies are shackled to a particular version of capitalism, that is going to be how they work. What's the useful way of your work getting in between what is basically the religion of those companies and what they're doing to us?
I would say right now, one of the things that they do seem aware of and thinking about, but don't know how to handle, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you know, whomever, is the way that scale is playing against them now. The way in which these numbers, the metrics, the focus on growth, the obsession, the need to always be growing plays out in Silicon Valley creates an opening for a new kind of social media network, for example, that by design isn't meant to always grow or isn't meant to always have more users, that maybe it has less users as a value. Or maybe what if someone built a social network that I only wanted to play with once a day and that was it as a user? It seems counterintuitive, but there's a conflict now between capitalism's need for endless growth and humanity's need for privacy and the preservation of privacy and the protection of democracy and to avoid the negative effects of ubiquitous surveillance. In other words, as a society, we've now started to realize that maybe where we're headed with some of these technologies in terms of scale and data surveillance aren't good things. So there's a balance perhaps that could tip in a different direction between just endless profit generation and protection of the things that we most care about.
Can we tip it, though?
I don't know. I mean, I'm doing whatever I can do from my side of the equation there.
Ben Grosser there, and his digital defense workshop takes place on Saturday as part of the new show by collaborative duo Kennedy Brown at the Hugh Lane Gallery, Dublin. How did the Victorians manage without Facebook? Well, they didn't have to, according to our guest this time, wallpaper designer Charlotte Corrie, because of the explosion onto the scene of the portrait carte de visite. In 1859, the cost of photography plummeted, and the immortality that we now know through the selfie became, if not universal, much more widely available. These cards and their collectors, along with the poor taxidermy that was also widespread in the period, now power Corrie's work as a wallpaper designer, as she told Culturefile's Eleanor Flegg.
I've spent most of my life detesting wallpaper. The last thing I would ever dream of putting on walls I live in is wallpaper.
I'm counting wallpaper roses.
Mainly because I had a mother who got married young, had four of us before she was 30, had done a degree in languages at Oxford and done nothing with it. And she was obsessed with wallpapering our little semi-detached house in North London. There weren't that many walls to paper. And she had my father changing the wallpaper. I think they must have spent he was a school teacher, must have spent every penny they had. Apples one week, Lascaux Caves another. Very often I come down in the morning, oh my God, it had changed again. This went on for years. I just remember her screaming and screeching about the wallpaper, and she preferred the one that had been up 3 weeks back, and of course you couldn't retrieve it, and somehow it was everybody's fault. I think it was her way of expressing her total dissatisfaction with life.
And make my wallpaper roses bloom again.
But then, very oddly, I went to a school and it had a very, very good art block run by somebody who's now extremely famous for her wallpapers. She was called Peggy Angus. She created, she hand-blocked wallpaper. All her papers are reproduced and she's extremely famous, and I'm astonished to think that she taught me when I was 10. She was very short, so she was as tall as I was, and she always smelled of garlic. She was completely exotic and wonderful and had a very profound impression on me. And only now, all these years on, I think, why ever didn't we talk about wallpaper? It's like I've caught up with her decades later. I think she'd be very amused at the way I'm using digital technology, where she was sort of practically making her wallpapers out of potato prints.
Your wallpaper.
wallpapers are patterns upon patterns. At the background, you have old-fashioned block print. And then on top, you have Victorian portraits of animals in human clothes.
Once people used to say that photographs don't lie, but with modern digital technology, photographs don't need to tell the truth at all. I've been interested in Victorian photography for a long time, and so I started playing with the various sort of iconography of Victorian photographers were developing. And I'd photograph a lot of stuffed animals so that the animals are the same age as the photographs, and then melding them. And what's very interesting about Victorian taxidermy is that quite often it's hopeless because they didn't know what the animals looked like. A polar bear's skin would come back to be stuffed and they'd have to make up the structure.
The people in the portraits are taken from Victorian visiting cards.
Yeah, carte de visite they were called because people had dozens printed and handed them out to people. And I don't know whether people really use them like calling cards, you know, like I'd give you my business card. But certainly at the period when carte de visite became very, very popular, it was when the price spiraled down and people were encouraged to buy 12, 25, I've seen. It was like Victorian Facebook. I'd go and get photographs of myself done and then you'd have photographs of yourself done and we'd swap one. And then the photographers were in on something really good here because they'd sell albums and you'd start collecting all your friends, celebrities, royalty, actresses, whoever. And just like Facebook, you want to show off that you've got loads of friends, but you didn't necessarily know them all. I used to look at these little carte de visite in junk shops and they're exquisite. The photographers paid a lot of attention to the painted backdrop, the props, because people would stand, well, they'd stand with stands holding them still because you had to stand still for 3 minutes. They'd put a clamp on your neck, a clamp around your waist. There's often columns and chairs and drapery disguising these clamps because they're unknown ancestors. They've lost their provenance. People don't want them. I've given them a new life.
What possessed you to put animal heads on them?
Well, I remember just doing a few for fun and then realising it wasn't fun. It was actually a very serious process. I think the first one I did, I put an owl on a gentleman because he looked very owlish to me. He looked like a school teacher or a vicar. So your first reaction is actually, that's quite funny. And then the more I looked, the more I thought, well, actually, it's making me look at the picture far more than when he had a boring human head. You take away the human face and then you're forced to look at all the clues in the picture. That choice of shoe, that brooch, why is she standing like this? Why is he slopping like that? These are the clues to that person. By giving him a badger's face, you really see what's in the picture.
So you've got a picture within a picture and then it's going on the walls. So I suppose that the life that's lived in that room is another layer of story imposed over that.
Well, you can't get away from them because you walk into a room with them on the wall and they have a massive presence. But I'm not sure I could live with them. They would dominate you in your sitting room. But do you know what it really is? It's fantastic. It's not allowing those images, not allowing the old stuffed animals, not allowing the old blocks to just slip away. It's giving it all a new life. Make it your diet's every resolve from now
to eat like the old warthog. Do their beady eyes follow you?
Yes. Yes. Particularly the it's punks for every meal. The warthog, wherever you are in the room, he's watching what you're up to. No need to cook or pee. I got it all worked out. Eat some in their skin. Got a little wood sound.
Wallpaper designer Charlotte Corrie there on her Visitorians designs, and the reporter was Eleanor Flegg.
Hugh Cooney is a filmmaker, painter, comedian, and now a storyteller. Cooney hit upon YouTube as a platform for performance art early on, creating gonzo characters whose sincerity was never less than dubious. His current origin story goes that after a stint at the National Leprechaun Museum, Cooney has now found himself drawn to the ancient art of the Shanachie. This week he presents Hugh Cooney's stories at Project in Dublin, where Áine Gallagher went to meet him fireside to take in some tales.
And then she heard whistling.
Well, as a comedian, it's a really, really handy vessel for me to hang jokes on. It's a vessel for me to kind of have the crack with. There's a thing with stand-up, it's although you will think that people, it looks like they're doing stuff off the cuff. It's kind of obviously designed to do that, and people have their routines. And stand-up comedy is probably the continuation of that kind of oral tradition in a modern sense. And I think I'm just kind of like looking back. They're very similar, but I'm giving it a kind of ye olde kind of feel.
Do you feel like maybe in this new contemporary, almost homogenized kind of Ireland that we're in, that the storytelling tradition has been lost?
There's a huge folk revival in Ireland, like folk music is thriving. But I think that this Shanachie storytelling aspect of things has kind of almost been left behind. Now, that's not to say that there aren't current versions of that. I think that it still exists online with, you know, kind of viral online comedians and like the Tony Cantwell, I think Blind Boy's a prime example.
Sprinkle the eggshells into the pot, and as the water boils down, if it's a fairy, it'll reveal itself, and if it does...
We had the notions, the ancient laws of hospitality. You know, you'd have storytellers going door to door, and they go to entertain, they get fed. And I think in such an inhospitable time, or a time where we've got so much homelessness, maybe re-examining our... these like ancient laws of hospitality in Ireland, are they still intact? Could be interesting to kind of start testing those laws, do you know?
It's as if I can hear them down there, swept in that other world, learning how to whistle.
Hugh Cooney there, and Hugh Cooney's stories is now returns only at Project Arts Centre Dublin. And that brings to a close this here edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more double-edged homages at 7 p.m. next Friday. Till then, bye now.